You're listening to Branch Out by Sycamore.
Anybody who can make a little bit of a commercial for Pepto-Bismol, send it in. People are going to vote on it once again. I rode my bicycle down to California. They have Safeways. The adrenaline's going. There's random people just looking for their orange juice in the aisle. But I figured if this is only going to last 30 seconds, a minute, you know, I could pull it off without some disruptions. Wrote a little jingle, put the laptop on a grocery cart, and then got to it. Is that nauseated feeling driving you insane? I got something for you that can soothe your pain. You know, da 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 da. Pepto, Pepto-Bismol, baby. And you know, hit him with the backflip and the splits, I think.
I'm Larson Hicks, CEO of Sycamore, and welcome to Branch Out, where I chat with healthcare professionals about broad-reaching topics like their careers in medicine, hobbies and pursuits outside the hospital, and everything in between. On this episode, I'm joined by Dr. Ronnie Tisdale, a graduate of Stanford who trained at the Icahn School of Medicine at Mount Sinai in New York, and he's currently finishing his emergency medicine residency in Selma, Alabama. Dr. Tisdale walks through the four pillars that have shaped him: academics, athletics, creativity, and humanitarianism. We take a deep dive into the defining moments of his life, including rugby, Brazilian jiu-jitsu, music, and the performing arts. He even sings a little bit for us. Here's Dr. Ronnie Tisdale.
Well, hey, Dr. Tisdale, it's great to have this opportunity to chat with you. Welcome to Branch Out with Sycamore.
It's a pleasure to be here. It's a pleasure to be able to branch out with Sycamore. I love the tree reference. I appreciate the opportunity.
Where are you? Are you in Alabama? Is that what I read?
Yes, I'm currently in the rural deep south in historic Selma, Alabama. I've been a little bit all over, I would say, the United States, and most recently have settled down in Dallas County, the Black Belt of the South, as they say, for the rich, fertile black soil that happens to inhabit the area historically. I think it was doing a pretty good job with King Cotton for a while. I believe there was a bit of success there in the early 20th and 19th centuries. But you know, since then, we've been delving into other industries.
So how long have you been in Alabama?
About a year and a half now. I've been here, and it's certainly growing on me, as New York City did prior to that, and as Central California did prior to that. There's a lot to explore. It's definitely a cultural shock and a cultural change from being in the hustle and bustle of New York City. I won't say anything particularly bad or incriminating about New York City, but I'll notice in contrast, you know, just in the public spaces, it smells a little better here. There's a little bit more space to enjoy. The air just feels a little bit more pure. It's definitely cheaper down here. And at least at face value, the people can be a little bit more personable. In New York City, there's a fair amount of hustle and bustle once again. Everyone has a place to go.
So you didn't grow up in Alabama. Sounds like you've traveled around a little bit. Are you currently practicing emergency medicine? Are you finishing residency right now, or you are already through?
I get to do a little bit of both. I'm with UAB, Selma Family Medicine, primarily. I'm grateful to be under the tutelage of Dr. Tiffany Maycock, Dr. Quendo, Dr. Wells, and Dr. Conwall, a good faculty and staff out there, and all of my co-residents. But yes, as a senior resident, I'm still finishing up residency, but also have the opportunity to moonlight, mainly on the weekends and holidays. So I'm glad to be able to do that for Sycamore. And working with Sycamore has been great, just because the whole process of getting started was just so streamlined. You know, when I first got my medical license, you know, obviously that was a fair amount of paperwork and it can be quite overwhelming. But what I noticed particularly about Sycamore is that the people you're working with to get all of your contracting taken care of seem to be fairly on top of everything you need, whether it's email, fax, scanning, and ensuring that they give you adequate time to get these things taken care of and the appropriate support to do so. Seems like they've been doing it a while. So you know, I really appreciate the streamlined service, and it's been great.
Is this the first year you've been able to start moonlighting?
It is. Been outstanding to be able to work with Dr. Pignon, Dr. Bohannon, Dr. Hicks here in the emergency department with Vaughan Regional Medical Center, a small regional medical center in the Deep South, as we mentioned. But you know, given that I've been able to get my medical license, I now have an unrestricted medical license in the state of Alabama. I'm able to work in the emergency department and really take advantage of these weekends that we do have free.
You don't really get a whole lot of free time, do you, as a resident?
Not particularly. I mean, Monday through Friday, your schedule is usually pretty packed, whether you're working days or nights. And then usually at least a weekend or two, you might have something to do depending on what your rotation might be. The beauty of family medicine and emergency medicine that you get to experience a little bit of everything, from the obstetrics and gynecology to pediatrics to surgery to the clinic to the emergency department to the ICU even, particularly during this COVID-19 pandemic. We've really been on the front lines from the emergency department through the hospital floors and up to the ICU. So we really see the full spectrum of it. And it's really an interdisciplinary approach. We're really pleased to be able to see how we can make an impact in multiple ways.
So just to kind of back up a little bit, I think your story, as I've kind of just gotten a little bit familiar with it, is really interesting. So how did you end up in medicine in the first place? What kind of led you to this as a career? And what other career choices were you kind of considering? Or are you still considering, I should say?
So I can take it to the beginning. Born and raised in Northwest Ohio, in Toledo, and my family moved us to Perrysburg, Ohio, which is a suburb of Toledo, very early on. And we didn't have a whole lot of money, but my parents gave me a fair amount of opportunity. And you know, both my mother and father, I always saw them working hard my whole life. And my mother in particular, I did see her in healthcare. And it's her work in phlebotomy that gave me a fair amount of insight to the medical profession, because she would come home and tell me these stories about these heroic and caring docs that would be able to intervene at a moment's notice and oftentimes do everything necessary to improve a patient's condition and cure an ailment. And it was really my desire to do that, coupled with my pure fascination with the human body from an early age, that really got me into medicine. So I'm grateful to, you know, both my parents, but as far as healthcare goes, particularly my mom, who kind of opened up that window and that pathway to realize that I could work in healthcare. You know, she let me come into the clinic or the office or the hospital every once in a while just to be able to see what she was up to. And she really instilled that passion in me, I would say. So it was, yeah, grateful for that.
So got kind of a taste for medicine with your mom growing up with phlebotomy. When did you kind of make that decision? Like, I'm definitely going for medical school. How young were you?
That really did spark my interest, certainly. But my parents gave me so many more opportunities than just academics. You know, from a young age, they had me, I think maybe 3 years old, as young as that, I was on the wrestling mats. My brother served in the Marine Corps for a while and now works for CSX on the railroad. He was a wrestler from early on. So they threw me out on the mats at 3 years old. And that's an age where, you know, you don't know what you're doing. You just see another little kid there. And if you've ever watched little kids wrestling or doing any type of grappling, it's one of the most hilarious, cutest things that I've ever seen.
Oh, yeah.
Just because, you know, you're essentially thrown onto the mat and one kid either runs away or he just kind of tackles the other guy.
Yeah.
And that's essentially what happened, guy or girl in some cases. And so I think that's what I did. I ran out of there. I tackled the other kid. You know, I think maybe the ref kind of called it. And then I started crying. So, you know, hey, you won.
Tears of joy. Yeah.
So I don't know which one it was. It was just maybe I was overwhelmed by the experience. But
that's awesome.
You know, it was cool to start off that young. And of course, my brother being 10 years older than me, he was one of those kind of healthy bullies in a way.
Okay.
You know, he bullied me just enough to toughen me up and keep me aggressive, but he was never harming me. And I think that also is what helped instill in me that kind of athletic competitive edge. And then to on top of that, of course, there were the church choirs, and I was also in a traveling show choir as early as elementary school, traveling all around Northwest Ohio and Ohio areas, doing the jazz hands and singing Broadway tunes with the sequin vests that sparkle and blind you. So doing what I call the four pillars, academics or being a scholar in general, being one of them in no particular order. Athletics, sports, fitness, exercise being another one. Creativity, music or art. And of course, humanism or being of service to humanity and the community. Those have kind of been my four pillars from a young age. And as early as 3, 4, or 5, I've always had some hand in doing all of those things. So my parents and my brother giving me those opportunities allowed me to continue along that path. And it was about high school where having these four pillars, I decided, hey, you know, we're going to go for professional football maybe.
Yeah.
You know, if that works out, we're going to definitely take that route. And then, you know, if I could pull off being the next Denzel Washington, Jamie Foxx, Will Smith, Robert De Niro, you know, we'll do that.
Yeah.
And then, you know, also just in case, we'll also, you know, stay studying and work on the physician pathway, because that's what I've always been passionate about.
That's awesome.
You know, also the philanthropy and the altruism has always been on the front of my mind. So high school, it solidified once again, to make the short story long.
Yep.
And I actually took a circuitous pathway into getting out west to California. So in high school, you're in class sometimes, and if you're a decent athlete, you get letters from schools.
Right.
And they kind of just drop them off in the classroom or in your little cubby or near your locker. And I would get letters from Harvard and Yale and, you know, kind of smaller schools in the area, University of Toledo, Bowling Green. And one of the few Division I well-known top-notch schools that kind of was showing me love, so to speak, was Stanford. And I really didn't know them as a academic institution, really. Growing up in the Midwest, you're not really familiar with Stanford. You might just know them from football or basketball.
Right.
So I got a letter one day, and I saw that they were interested, and they said, hey, come out to football camp with us. And I wasn't necessarily rolling in the dough at the time. I think over the summers, I was doing roofing on the hot rooftops of Toledo, Ohio, in the middle of the sun. So I scrounged up some money for a Greyhound bus ticket out to California. One summer, I think I paid my $200 round trip ticket, hopped on a Greyhound bus. My parents drove me to the station, I think begrudgingly. So like, what are you doing? You know, why don't you just fly? Figure it out. I'm pretty sure they probably were like, hey, look, we'll give you a couple hundred, just fly. But, you know, I was kind of in it for the experience.
Yeah, totally.
In addition to that, so I got on the bus. It was a 3-day trip there, obviously through all of the Midwestern states and to the West Coast. Showed up in California 3 days later, met a bunch of cool individuals on the way there from, migrant workers that were traveling from the East Coast to the Northwest because of, you know, some change in the crop or improved job opportunities out there, from traveling salesmen to other students and such. And ended up going to football camp out there, fell in love with the campus. You know, if you've ever been to Stanford University, you go down something called Palm Drive and there's nothing but palm trees. And at the end of this, seems like it's probably at least 3/4 mile long drive called Palm Drive. It's called Memorial Church, and the sun sets often, you know, seems like right next to it. And it's just a beautiful experience. So I fell in love, and I said, look, whether or not I end up playing college football, I'm definitely coming to this place. And once again, realizing that it's also a top-notch academic institution as well. It's not just football.
Yeah. So. Yeah.
I ended up as a senior in high school playing for Team USA in something called the Global Junior Championships X. Okay. So they got a bunch of well-known high school football players from the area that were doing pretty well. And they had us, even though it was just people really in the Midwest, they had us represent Team USA.
Wow.
And we played against Germany and Canada and Japan and Mexico. Some of those countries you didn't know had football teams, but trust me, they're pretty good. And, I got a chance to practice and play with a great group of guys all in the Midwest. And I actually ended up, though we ended up performing pretty well, I tore my ACL on one of the kickoffs in one of those games. So needless to say that the scholarship process wasn't the smoothest for me in terms of playing football, but I said, hey, once again, I've committed, I'm coming to Stanford anyway. So applied to Stanford University as the only school I applied to formally via early admission.
Mm-hmm.
I got in and my whole family was ecstatic, and I ended up devoting a good portion of my senior year to applying for private scholarships.
Okay.
In high school, once again, I was doing all of the musicals and the plays.
Right.
I was the Wiz in the Wiz. I was the lead ballet dancer in Oklahoma. If you know Oklahoma, where the wind comes, So I was doing the whole ballet. I'd never done ballet in my life, but now I was really flexible and a strong guy. So they were like, hey, let's put him here.
That's awesome.
So I was doing all the plays. I was a three-sport athlete. Football, track, and wrestling. And my senior year, I said, let's not do one of the musicals so I can focus on these scholarships. Ended up getting probably at least a dozen or a couple dozen private scholarships. And I'm grateful to the Ron Brown Scholarship Program, the Gates Millennium Scholarship Program from Bill and Melinda Gates, Toyota and the Elks Club, and the Scholar Athlete Milk Mustache of the Year Award. If you've ever seen the ESPN magazine, Sports Illustrated, they got those kids and famous athletes with the milk mustache. They pick about a couple dozen high school athletes that really represented their region well. They flew my mom and dad out to Orlando, as well as me, to accept this award for being Sammy, or the Scholar Athlete Milk Mustache of the Year Award.
That's awesome.
Wow, you're taking me back. I got these scholarships, and I was able to help pay for Stanford regardless of whether or not I was playing football. I ended up playing rugby.
Oh, baby. One of the best programs in the country, man. And historic program.
I think Navy and BYU are pretty good, too.
And, of course, Cal Berkeley.
Oh, Cal, yeah. You seem like you play rugby yourself. Yeah, how do you know all this?
I played rugby, and I coached rugby at Washington State University. So, yeah.
Wow. Thank you for your contribution to the sport.
Oh, yeah, man.
I think maybe you enjoy it for the same reasons, but for me, it was the international aspect of it as well. Just to meet people from all over the country. First of all, you're at Stanford, but then I think rugby itself tends to bring even more of an international aspect to the people that you're going to meet and build bonds and relationships with. So, I fell in love with that, got to do that. I actually made it to be able to play with Team USA and rugby as well while at Stanford. They flew us out to Tucson, Arizona, I think it was, to play against Canada. And I also went out to Atlanta to do kind of a trial for Team USA, the U19s, against Life Point University. And that was pretty fun. We played in Ireland. A few of my Stanford colleagues as well.
What position did you play?
They moved me around a bit. I played 12 mostly, but when it came down to sevens, they either had me, oddly enough, they had wing a little while, and then I was a hooker at one point. So it seemed kind of versatile. But it's been a while since I played a bit of rugby. That's bringing up great memories. My sophomore year, I believe it was, taking it back to your original question about going into medicine, I always knew I was into becoming a doctor in that pathway. So as early as my sophomore year at Stanford, I applied to what was then known as the Humanities in Medicine program. And it was and still is an early admission program. It's since changed names. But it allows you to gain early acceptance to what was then known as Mount Sinai School of Medicine, now Icahn School of Medicine, after Carl Icahn's $200 million donation. Shout out to Mr. Carl Icahn. Thank you for that donation. Corporate raider, as he is known. I don't mean to offend you, sir, but that's what Wikipedia says about you. Pretty streamlined application process. I think I found out by the middle of my sophomore year that I had been admitted to medical school. So I was able to really study what I wanted in college. I ended up double majoring in human biology and drama. At the time, it was called humanities and medicine. So they really were looking for individuals that were interested in the humanities. That is, people studying political science, music, art, anthropology, sociology, things like that. And I got the best of both worlds studying drama, which I loved, and got to take a fair amount of music classes. I really learned to play piano at Stanford University, because every dorm on campus has a piano, believe it or not, and even every cafeteria. So I got to a point where I was able to kind of pick out individuals that I knew grew up with classical piano lessons, and I would sit back and look over their shoulder, or you know, develop a decent relationship with them, and they'd show me a thing or two. So I like to say that you know, Stanford was the place where I learned to play piano from my peers. In many ways, of course, you got to teach yourself a fair amount from YouTube videos and, you know, just practicing scales and things. But yeah, so the humanities and medicine program gave me a lot of leeway there, and you got to take a fair amount of anatomy and such. And actually, didn't have to take the MCAT, which is something that can be a limiting factor for a lot of people, particularly you know, minorities, individuals from low-income backgrounds that don't perform as well on standardized tests in many ways. So we're grateful to Mount Sinai for that opportunity and what they're doing to help improve the admission process to medical school. Now it's called the FlexMed program. I actually am fortunate enough to have named it. When I got to Mount Sinai, there were wondering how they can kind of transition this program and improve its branding and such. And I don't know if it was because they knew I had a little bit of the creativity aspect, or if I was just kind of enthusiastic individual in general, but they put me on this naming committee, and people were going around looking for new names of the program. And people were, let's call it this. And I think on a whim, I was just like, you know, flexibility. There's this guy named Abraham Flexner that really contributed to medical education. Call it FlexMed. And they were like, we got it.
I liked humanities and medicine, man. That's what was called humanities.
Yeah, I think part of the reason they changed the name is because they realized that while recruiting individuals that are interested in humanities is great, is, you know, medicine's kind of transitioning in which to a point at which we could really use people in computer science or physics or robotics or economics or finance. So I think they really opened it up to individuals that were studying not just the humanities, but anything that could be contributory or anything that would be beneficial to medicine outside of the strict basic science aspect.
That makes sense. I'm a huge, huge fan of liberal arts and humanities and the arts. And I think it's a big shame that so many folks in medicine in particular have never had that kind of background and that kind of exposure. Because if all you do is pre-med, you know, from the time you're in high school till you know, you start seeing patients, there's a lot of the human experience that you sort of miss out on, which obviously through you've picked up through drama, but also through sports and through a lot of other avenues, which I think is awesome.
Yeah, it's been a good experience. Good go at it so far.
I saw Brazilian Jiu-Jitsu on there as well.
Yeah. Now, BJJ.
Are you more of a Gracie guy? Are you like a 10th Planet guy?
You know your stuff. So do you do Jiu-Jitsu as well?
No. I'm just a big fan.
Wow. So you're well informed. You're well informed. So I guess as they say, your lineage, or who do you train under? Eventually, it did come. Everybody came indirectly from the Gracies, but I've competed and trained historically since medical school under Team Jucau. So Jucau, or Ailson Enrique Brites, is a 6th degree black belt, and he, I believe, was trained by Carlos Gracie Jr. I think he started at Equipe Serrano or Academia Serrano out in Teresópolis, Brazil, which I believe is outside of Rio de Janeiro, if I'm not mistaken. You should double check my geography. I've never been to Brazil, but I'd love to go. But yeah, he set up shop out in Manhattan, out on the Upper West Side, when I was living on the Upper East Side. Mount Sinai, as you might know, is located between one of the richest, most privileged neighborhoods in the world, being Carnegie Hill, and one of the poorest neighborhoods, East Harlem. And I would just ride my bicycle across Central Park to the Upper West Side and train with both Professor Jukau and another professor of mine, Luis Garena, who's also a black belt and a great friend of mine. And you have a lot of competition in terms of Brazilian Jiu-Jitsu schools in New York City in particular. You got Unity, which is the Miao brothers. You got, I believe, Henzo Gracie. You have Marcelo out there. Just a plethora of people set up in Manhattan to take advantage of the interest out there. For our listeners that don't know, I should explain that Brazilian Jiu-Jitsu is an art. It's a martial art in particular, but some people say, you know, it doesn't necessarily need to be martial. It doesn't necessarily have to have anything, you know, military or rigid or structured about it. It's a sport, and some would argue a fiercely competitive combat sport, which people rely on for their livelihood. It is just a basic form of fitness and exercise and form of mental wellness for others. And it's a form of self-defense. So it's a lot of things. In organizations or leagues like the UFC or ONE Championships, it's probably the most commonly used and the most practical form of fighting, if you want to call it that. I hate to call it fighting because that turns people off. Yeah, I'm not really a fighter. I'm a lover, not a fighter. You know, hey, it's first and foremost a way to get your body moving and to combat the obesity pandemic that we have around the world. But it's the gentle art. Jiu-jitsu, coming from the Japanese, ju meaning soft or gentle, jitsu meaning art or technique or form in many ways. It's just a beautiful form of martial art and sport and exercise that was passed on through a Japanese gentleman who had migrated to Brazil and showed a bunch of people how to do this art form. It transformed a bit more into a sport and then migrated subsequently to the United States. And now it's picked up traction. Ever since UFC 1, I think people really saw one of the Gracies cranking it out. So I guess you can call the Gracie guy. Everybody that does BJJ is a Gracie guy, because everyone likes to think that the Gracies were the first to adopt. And really they were, but they also had a lot of competition nearby. But yes, Team Jukau, if you get a chance. And we're really working on setting up some Brazilian Jiu-Jitsu out here. Of course, it's tough with the pandemic. So it's been kind of on and off out here, and we like to try to stay as safe as possible. But we've worked with the local YMCA here in Selma, Dallas County. We've worked with the Edmonites Missions, which is a Catholic order who have contributed substantially to the well-being of the Selma community. And you know, they've both been willing to help with our spreading interest in Brazilian Jiu-Jitsu around here.
My boys and I had looked into Gracie University, and they've got the Gracie Garage.
Yes, yes.
I know there's one at Birmingham. I don't know about in Selma, but we thought about trying to do something like that here.
So Henner Gracie in Hidon, I think, and that's with an R, but with the in Portuguese, the R's are H's. So those two guys are outstanding athletes and seemingly great people and great marketers as well and great role models. And they just do a great job at advocating for the sport. And yeah, they do have the online university there. And there's a bit of controversy, I think, within the jiu-jitsu community, because people are saying, oh, how can you get this online blue belt? Because as you know, BJJ is one of the most rigid, structured competitive, if you want to call it that, difficult arts in terms of being able to promote oneself in terms of belt, white, blue, purple, brown, black. And I think that there's no substitute for getting on the mat with a partner, whether it's just one partner. I learned primarily through Lewis, Professor Lewis Garena and Professor Jukau. So there's no substitute for being able to feel and gain that muscle memory for some of the moves. But you know, I, of course, look at YouTube and Twitter and Instagram and check out the latest, greatest moves and the greatest athletes. And that's a great way to do it, too. Just find a mat and a partner if you can to really enjoy the art.
How do you feel like these things, you know, the drama, the arts, the music, the rugby, the football, I mean, all of these things have made you into the person you are today. And but I'm curious to hear how you feel like those things have affected the way that you approach medicine, you know, the way that you treat patients. I mean, do you feel like you can draw straight lines from some of those experiences to how you, to what you do on a day-to-day basis in the ER?
I don't know if I would certainly call them straight. I'll say from the get-go, I do like to try to separate them as much as possible. You have your guys like Ken Jeong, if you're familiar with him. The
comedian and actor, yeah.
Yes, comedian, actor. He likes to state that he's the Asian doctor guy that's out there doing comedy, the naked guy that jumped out of the car in The Hangover. He's done a great job at integrating because I think he really started with the comedy and then he got one of his first major roles, I think, in Knocked Up. And he kind of found his way through there. And then you have, of course, someone like Dr. Oz, who's a physician, a surgeon at first. And he was able to integrate that in terms of his media and his advocacy for health. But, I like to keep them separate if I can. I do my work and do my caring for patients and learning as much as possible each day. And then, you know, when that's over, you know, now we're a jiu-jitsu, okay? Or when that's over, you know, now we're an artist or a performer. But there is some interplay there. I think that there's humanity in it all and realizing that through all these things, it does require a certain amount of structure in planning to become your best. You can't just go out there every day without a plan and expect to excel on a daily basis. So really looking at things from a framework of constant improvement and excellence is something I take away from all of them. One is a bit of performing because you're really having to perform ideally in all of those fields.
I don't know if it was Dr. Lou Profeta or another physician who does a lot of writing and blogging, but this concept, this idea that there is a degree of acting that's involved in medicine. I mean, you have to portray confidence, you have to sympathize and empathize, and a lot of that involves being able to kind of have control of your own emotions and your own, you know, ability to kind of communicate. And so I'm sure that a lot of that comes into play too.
Sure, of course. And for me, it's mainly the optimal performance. I spoke about performing previously. And, you know, before football games or before rugby matches, you know, my shoes had to be laced a certain way. You know, I had to wear my socks, you know, just like this. You know, I had to have taken a shower at this time. I had to have eaten a certain number of hours beforehand. Similarly, before a musical performance or before a play or an act, you don't want to have indigestion in the middle of delivering your lines. You know, you got to eat a certain time before that. You know, your uniform has to be or your wardrobe has to have appropriate placement in the wings when you need. There's a lot of preparation that takes place before these things. Obviously, there's practice involved with all these venues. And similarly, in medicine, before an ER shift, you know, you really have to be in optimal fitness of your mind, body, and soul before you go in there. So, you know, I really like to obviously make sure I've gotten enough sleep the night before, but, you know, make sure I'm adequately hydrated and have adequate sustenance and I have access to what I need if I can get away for just a few minutes during the middle of a shift. And it's really that optimal performance aspect, I think, that requires adequate preparation beforehand and during to really stay at your best. And that's the biggest overlap, is being able to take care of every other aspect of your life and ensure that that's optimized while doing your job. You really have to be present for the task at hand to do that.
Another thing we talk to a lot of physicians about is just the idea that you've got to have other things outside of the hospital, outside of the practice, you know, that you're engaged in, because if you don't, you burn out and you take that stress home with you. And have you found that to be the case with your practice so far?
I certainly have. I think when you don't have anything, you know, planned after the shift, whether it's the emergency department or the clinic, you end up having your work just spill into that next hour or two after. You know, if you have something else planned after, whether it be exercise or an actual competition, or that you're going to pursue some artistic outlet, then it's inevitably going to spill into that activity. So I'm really an advocate of having that outlet, just because it improves your efficiency in one way. In the back of your mind, you know that, look, we have to do this as efficiently as possible because we have other things to do. And obviously for mental health and sanity, it's good not just to focus on that one thing. And I agree with you. It does really improve other aspects of your life beyond just the physical benefits and cognitive benefits of having an exercise outlet. So, yes, I'm in complete agreement with that.
So for a guy who's gotten really fat ever since he stopped competing in sports, what's your, like, for me, it's hard to motivate myself to get, like, to exercise if it's not driving towards a competition, you know? And I don't, it sounds like you're still competing in different ways. Is that kind of the secret, or have you gotten to that point yet?
First of all, I think you look like you're in great shape from this end. So I wouldn't call yourself, if you're referring to yourself, I wouldn't say that's you. So for me, it is heavily competition, but for another individual that might not be as competitive or not into Brazilian Jiu-Jitsu, I would say part of it is the camaraderie. I think personal trainers and other fitness gurus have mentioned how important it is to have a partner, someone else that's going to hold you accountable and hold you to a different standard than you might set yourself. Just because it's so easy when you have so many other things going on. You might have family, children. Obviously, you have work. You might have some obligations beyond that at home or a side project. I think having another individual, whether it's your significant other or it's a friend of yours, that is able to really hold you accountable, and so you're able to push each other. And you don't even have to have the same level of fitness. You don't even have to be at the same level of strength or speed or what have you. I think it's really just depending on another person when it comes to 6 o'clock in the morning and, you know, your alarm goes off and you think, let me sleep in another hour. Or, hey, Jimmy or Sarah are waiting on me at the gym. So maybe we should get up and respect them. And you end up respecting yourself in many ways when you put the burden on yourself to really have another person rely on you.
So Ohio, Midwest, you're out in Stanford, which is a totally different vibe. New York, which obviously is a completely different vibe. And then Selma, man. Pretty different. When you go on from Selma and residency, what do you think is kind of the ideal kind of environment for you? I mean, is there a particular kind of community and kind of setting that you feel called to?
No, I'm hoping I can bounce around a bit because I've enjoyed facets of each location. Of course, the Midwest, you know, Toledo area, Northwest Ohio was home. So you have that personability, you have the nostalgia that anyone obviously has, or most people have, for their hometown. In the West Coast, you know, it's laid back. I fell in love with California because of the combination of the Red Hot Chili Peppers, Tupac, and the Beach Boys, and how they describe California. And it met every expectation, I have to say. So,
Dr. Dre.
Yes. It's so laid back out there. And, you know, there's just a vibe about a carefree attitude out there. So that's one thing I love California. New York City, I loved the efficiency of life, the productivity, kind of the go-getter attitude. And I just appreciated that energy in New York City. There's always something to do. There's so much opportunity. It's infinite in New York City. And then, of course, in the South, of course, the laid-back attitude once again. But I think that it is really a place. People say that you never leave the South. You grow up here. You either come back or you're going to stay. There is something that feels like it's home down here. I mean, there's so much opportunity and potential for economic development, particularly here in Selma. We're a historic town. Obviously, some would argue is the heart or the soul of the civil rights movement, you know, right next to Montgomery and Birmingham, obviously. But it has often gone neglected in many ways, socioeconomically speaking. And that's where I really see the opportunity and the potential for growth, just because they're youth here that are so smart and have so much drive and willingness to succeed. I think that we need to provide them with the economic opportunities to do so. And, you know, I've had my wheels spinning in my mind there since I really realized that the potential here, and, you know, we could go on another couple hours about the industries that could be started here again. But, you know, I certainly see myself here in Alabama for at least the next few years beyond residency. Awesome. I'm grateful to Sycamore for obviously allowing me these opportunities and Northern Alabama, and hoping perhaps that could expand it to Central or Central Alabama as well. And if I'm able to continue these experiences, I see myself growing both in my career in medicine, but also expanding the Brazilian Jiu-Jitsu empire of Team Jukaus we have. We also need a lot of industries here, particularly in Selma. And that's in a variety of industries. And I look forward to being a part of that as well, if not just economically speaking, perhaps politically, because there's a lot that needs to happen in terms of political empowerment among a predominantly Black population here. We're over 80% Black. I don't think that we get the voter representation that we need to. So, you know, I see myself settling down here at least for the next few years. But, you know, emergency medicine life can be somewhat tumultuous sometimes. So, you know, I wouldn't mind bouncing back to New York City for a month or two to train with, you know, the home base of Team Jukau out there. But, you know, I really appreciate the opportunities out here in Alabama. And once again, it feels like home.
I'm up in Huntsville, Alabama, and there's some great jiu-jitsu up here. And also in Decatur, there's a number of 10th Planet dojos, gyms,
dojos. Yeah, I've been doing it for quite a few. Like I said, I wrestled since I was three. I've been doing jiu-jitsu about five, and I still struggle with what do you call it? Because, you know, you have your gym, you know, is it your club? Is it your dojo? Because I think once it becomes Brazilian jiu-jitsu, it moves out of, you know, we lose a little of the Japanese terminology, but at the same time, you still want to respect it in that way. We still have the obrigado, which is thank you in Portuguese. Or you have the us, which you say after you learn something, or yes, or respectfully. But, you know, it's interchangeable for me. Dojo, a gym. Where do you train, man? Your training facility. Where do you, you know? So, but, yeah, I know there's a lot of good jiu-jitsu up there. And we're expanding here in Alabama. And what's that? That goes back to the so much opportunity and so much potential because it's in New York. If you go to New York, you're not going to be at loss for a place to train. But here in Selma, other than BJJ Selma, which we've recently established as an actual group, training group, there's nothing else for an hour. And there's no other teams you count for an hour and a half drive. So we're all we got here. And so that means there's only moving up after this.
Yeah, that's awesome. Well, you know, rugby's another one of those sports. I started when I lived in Idaho. I started a boys. Well, I started a men's team, and we got really competitive, and then I started a boys league that's still going today. But what I love about rugby as a sport is that it's not really a skill sport. You know, like it's a toughness sport. You need to be athletic, but you mostly just need to be fit and willing to just work your butt off, you know, yeah. And right. And have some bravery, you know, I mean, you gotta be willing to run into tackle after tackle and you've got so many wonderful athletes, you know, in the South. And I've always thought like, if we just had like 2% of the football athletes in the South get into rugby, we would dominate the world, you know? Yeah. I mean, yeah. We really would. Yeah.
Now you got me fascinated though, because am I allowed to ask you questions during this? I'd love to, because you brought up Idaho out of nowhere. So how long were you in Idaho for?
I was in Idaho for 12 years.
Wow. And where in particular?
I was in a little town called Moscow, which is on the border of, it's in the Panhandle. It's about an hour and a half south of Spokane, Washington, and like 10 minutes from Pullman, Washington. So there was University of Idaho and there was Washington State University. We're both. And actually, Mike Leach, who's now in Mississippi, but he coached at Washington State. And, you know, he played rugby at BYU when he was a student, which is crazy. So he used to come. I coached at Washington State. And so he and several of his players used to come to our games, and he even encouraged his guys in the offseason to come play with us. So
that's awesome. Good for you. Once again, thank you for your contribution to the sport. You know, that's a cool opportunity. And I love how the United States is the king of just taking other countries' city names and just slapping it. Is it MOSCOW? Just like, yeah.
Yeah, it's spelled just like Moscow.
I love it. And the thing about BYU is in Navy, those guys are recruiting out of the Pacific Islands, man. They will just find any Tongan or Samoan gentleman out there.
Yeah, that's not fair.
Which is great, though. And I think anthropologically speaking, I think it has something to do with the missionaries going to those places and spreading, you know, Catholicism, Christianity in general, and then somewhere along the way, I think rugby was thrown in there too.
Dude, and you talk about some of the most beautiful singing you're ever going to hear is some of the Samoan rugby players singing hymns together. Oh, it makes me cry, bro.
Yes, and I'm also fascinated by the Black or African-American influence on the Pacific Islands in that way. I was in a cappella. I failed to mention at Stanford, I was also in a cappella groups. So, you know, we had a couple of Pacific Islanders actually in some of our groups out there, and that's another thing that one of my best friends is actually from Guam, and that's, you know, we're going on a tangent here, but that has to be stated that's probably the biggest untapped, undiscovered en masse talent out there are the musicians on the Pacific Islands. So shout out to my Pacific Islander.
I've got a guy who played, well, he played, he was a incredible athlete, D1. Linebacker at Washington State, who's just a beast. I think he went on to the NFL, and then I think he might have gotten injured or something. I can't remember, but we're still friends on Facebook. And he posted something the other day, and it was just he and his boys sitting in some shed singing, you know, a cappella they had a couple guitars. But they were just singing, you know, hymns together. And it was just like the most beautiful thing. And then somehow, I'm trying to find it now, I got into this. There's like some island that's been evangelized by these like Anglican missionaries. And they've set up like a full-on monastery. And some of the videos of these guys singing is some of the most beautiful stuff I've ever heard. But yeah, that's another passion of mine. I'm in here. Oh, here it is. It's the Melanesian Mission. Oh man, it's awesome.
Now you're changing my mind here. You talked about where I want to settle down. Now you're talking about all these Pacific Islands and the music and the athleticism. I'm like, maybe I'll go out to
the Solomon Islands.
Yes.
Yeah. Well, I mean, like you see, if you watch some of those games, like after the games, some of those international games with Tonga, after the game, those guys will go, you know, sit, get in a circle in the middle of the pitch and like pray together. And it's just like, it's a pretty cool culture and pretty amazing, amazing culture. So yeah, I'm big into that. We one of the things I've been doing in Huntsville, we've been here in Huntsville for about 6 years, and I started a thing called Beer and Hymns, where me and just a bunch of men, random dudes, gather at these pubs, around town, and we just sing hymns, together. Yeah. A cappella, which is tons and tons of fun. Great way to meet a bunch of crazy guys, but also just a blast.
That's pretty neat. I might have to crash one of these days up in Haleyville or somewhere nearby.
Yeah, man, absolutely. Tell me this though. You haven't gotten a whole lot into your music story. So I know that you've done some jingles. Is that right?
Yeah. So that also was another thing that started in college. So I told you, grew up doing the sequin vest, jazz singers, show choir, church choirs and all this.
Yeah.
I got to my freshman year at Stanford, and it was kind of the YouTube boom. You know, when YouTube had just come out, it was only a year or two old, I think, something like that. And people were putting a lot of videos out there, and you know, not a lot of the country, I think, knew about it, but it was starting to gain some popularity. And I think corporations were realizing that, and they were starting to have video contests.
Mm-hmm.
Tangentially, there was one video contest for the movie Pursuit of Happiness by Will Smith playing the role of Christopher Gardner.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
You know, how he went essentially from homelessness to extreme success in Wall Street, finance world, what have you, in San Francisco primarily, so it's not Wall Street. I guess it is finance success nonetheless.
Yeah.
So they had a video contest and they said, hey, you know, put your story out there on YouTube or this format that we're going to put, talk about your life, and we'll see. Maybe you could win an internship, much like Christopher Gardner was able to win a job. So I talked on this video about my story of playing in the Global Junior Championships, tearing my ACL, ended up going to Stanford, loving it. You know, they appreciated the success story. So I won an internship with the NFL the summer after that, my freshman and sophomore years. And in New York City, ended up actually volunteering in the neurology department at Mount Sinai. And I think that's kind of what snowballed into my eventual admission to Mount Sinai. They flew my dad and I out to Hollywood to meet Will Smith and J-Lo and Cuba Gooding Jr. and to be a part of the Pursuit of Happiness premiere. Okay, so this is all to say that that's what got me into making videos.
Yeah.
All right. Yeah. So then I was kind of on the lookout. I mean, I wasn't, you know, it wasn't the first thing that I was doing. I wasn't devoting my life to it, but I would see if there was a contest here, there was a contest there.
Sure.
And I believe it was JetBlue Airways had another competition that said, hey, you know, anyone can make a video talking about JetBlue or, you know, why we're a great company. Let's send it forward and people will vote on it. And so I was on my way to Ireland to compete in rugby. And I showed up a couple hours early. And if you've ever been to John F. Kennedy Airport, there used to be at least a big blue wall that says something like JetBlue Airways, da 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 da. And I walked by it and I was like, wow, this would be a great place to film this video. So, you know, I set my laptop down on a chair or something and got in front of the camera and wrote a little jingle. And I said, yeah, I'll say this and this and this. And JetBlue, something like that. I always had the same blues.
You got to give a little. Yeah.
And, you know, I did the little spin around, split, backflip thing. And it ended up working out. And I think it was like a minute long or something like that. And incidentally,
like a Tutti Frutti kind of vibe.
Yes. Yeah, that's exactly what it's. Little Richard. Yes. You know your stuff.
He's from Huntsville, Alabama.
Really? He passed recently, I think. Bless his soul. But a flight attendant was walking by in the middle of my jingle as I did the backflip or something. And she was like, JetBlue. And I was like, that was perfect. And I went by, and I think at the end of the video, JetBlue. People voted on it. I think they gave me like $1,000 and a free trip. They definitely gave me a free trip to Puerto Rico. So I ended up hanging out there. And so that was the first video contest. And then I became a little bit more on the lookout for things. And I think Boston Consulting Group had another one. And then Pepto-Bismol was a big one, because I think the whole country was really involved in this one. And they said, hey, anybody who can make a little bit of a commercial for Pepto-Bismol, send it in. People are going to vote on it once again. And you know, you could win. So once again, wheels are spinning. I'm like, how am I going to do this? I think it was at this time my sophomore year. I'm studying for this big human biology final. You know, there's a little bit of chemistry, biology, anatomy on this. But I said, hey, let me take it upon myself. I rode my bicycle down to, in California, they have Safeways. I think they still have that. So I rode my bike, because I didn't have a car at the time. Rode my bike a couple miles out to Safeway, put my laptop on a grocery cart in the pharmaceutical over-the-counter medication aisle, and got busy like I always do. Wrote a little jingle, put the laptop on a grocery cart, and then got to it. Is that nauseated feeling driving you insane? I got something for you that can soothe your pain. You know, da 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 da. Pepto, Pepto-Bismol, baby. And, you know, hit him with the backflip and the splits, I think. And then, you know, picked up the Pepto-Bismol, I think, and looked at it and maybe took it away. And then a lot of people see in that video that there's a Safeway employee that kind of comes through the back. Because I did, this is all impromptu out of nowhere. It's not like I warned Safeway, like, hey, guys, we're going to, like it's scripted. We're going to be filming here. I need you to clear this out. No, it's the adrenaline's going. There's random people just looking for their orange juice in the aisle. But I figured if this is only going to last 30 seconds, a minute, you know, I could pull it off without some disruption. So, and, you know, I used a MacBook Pro at that time, which I still have. And a friend of mine, Cameron Drake, convinced me to get. Shout out to Steve Jobs, I believe. Thank you. He was maybe the brainchild for that. Because that was the beginning when computers were starting to have cameras, too. You know, we're talking, what is this, 2007, 2008. These always had it, but it was a little cheaper to get that camera. So, you know, packed up the laptop, you know, went back, sent the video out, submitted it. And there were some great commercials. Shout out to everyone else who submitted great commercials for that Pepto-Bismol. But they voted on mine, decided it. They gave me the $15,000 check. I think I gave my parents a fair amount, my brother a little bit. My brother might have refused his portion. He was like, okay, I'm the big brother. But then I bought a Ford Taurus, a baby blue Ford Taurus with that. And I think the rest went to Uncle Sam. But beyond that, yeah. And then the last one, if I'm not boring you, and let me know if it gets too crazy.
No. This is delightful.
The last one was when I was a senior. No, I take that back. So between my senior year of college and my first year of medical school, I had the opportunity to just hang out at Stanford. The Gates Millennium Scholarship pays for 5 years of school. And I had already done summer school between my sophomore and my junior year, taking some drama classes, some piano classes, and hanging out with one of my best friends, Jamel Seagrave. Shout out to Jamel Seagrave, who's an engineer now, works for Ford. And so I had these extra couple semesters that I'm grateful to the Gates Millennium Scholarship, Bill and Melinda Gates, that they allowed me to really take classes that were going to prepare me ideally for medical school, things like anatomy, and take them, you know, out of love and passion, not to, you know, outcompete and take these weed out classes just that I can get the best grade. And I was really in, because there's a difference between, you know, learning for the love of it and learning to get a great grade and to outcompete. And I'm really grateful for that time at Stanford where I was able to learn some piano. And I was in the Stanford Salseros at the time, getting my "Esa negrita que va caminando, esa negrita tiene su tumbao," you know, getting my salsa on as a part of Stanford Salseros and taking piano. And I'm digressing, but in White Plaza, which is the student union area, during this summer off, a friend of mine gave me a call and he said, "Hey, Dr. Pepper is out here filming, man. And I know you're into this type of thing. So, I think they're giving out a scholarship, and they had a video camera. So he's like, hey, come out here, man. So I went out. I see the video camera set up. You know, the wheels are turning again. You know what I do. So I write a little jingle, and I get my friend to throw me a Dr. Pepper in the middle of me dancing and singing this jingle, swig the Dr. P. It's actually water at the time because I don't endorse high fructose corn syrup consumption. And then, you know, I hit him with the backflip splits, I think. And then a couple weeks later, I get a phone call. Hey, we'd love to fly you and a family member out for the ACC championship in Charlotte, North Carolina. I think it was Florida State and Va Tech that year, to throw a bunch of footballs in a fiberglass Dr. Pepper can to try to win $123,000. And I'm like, all right, I guess we could do that.
This is what you've been preparing your whole life for.
That's so random though, right? I mean, I prepared for the jingles and stuff, but nobody was preparing to throw a bunch of balls from 10 yards away. You know, I'm not John Elway.
You're a performer, man. You've been gearing up for this.
Yeah, I suppose so.
And you're a competitor.
True. So they flew five of us out there. I think that there was like a singer or somebody else that was in dental school or preparing to go to dental school. And then a couple other people, I think that had some other professional careers. And the day before the ACC championship, we all competed against each other to see which two would end up at the halftime show. And so we were throwing. And I think it was just me and the future dentist that were the two athletes of the group. So we ended up doing pretty well. And we tied. And then the very last time, I think he hit nine balls in and I hit nine. And they did kind of a mini overtime after that. And we tied again, but he had made the last ball. I don't recall exactly how it worked out. But then, so we both made it. It was the last two of us at halftime, the ACC championship, pressure's on, you know, throw 10 balls in as fast as you can. So, bah, 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 I think we both hit nine in. So then we had to have another overtime thing, and we both hit five in that overtime. So we tied at halftime. And there's a huge technicality, but they based it on the preliminary rounds with the halftime the day before. So he had, I think, made the last ball or something like that. So the fans were like booing because we tied at halftime, but they based it on what was before. So I got $23,000. The darn dentist, am I allowed to curse in here? Because I would curse in this.
I think so. You can drop the D word.
The damn dentist. See, this is why I have beef against dentists. You know, not only do they overcharge and take out wisdom teeth unnecessarily, you know, they also win $123,000 based on a false technicality. So if you're out there, guy that won $100,000 based on one football, I'm still a little salty after that one. So, but hey, I'm grateful for the $23,000. A lot of people didn't get that opportunity. They still hit me up every once in a while, because after that, they liked my story, and I think there's a couple videos floating around on the internet about me going to medical school and pursuing the sports and the arts and service and things like that. And they hit me up recently. I don't know if they're going to come. I told them, hey, you guys need to come out here to Selma, Alabama.
You got a spot right there on your scrubs for a deep Dr. Pepper logo. Just slap one on.
That's why I like to try to keep things separate, you know, because I feel like it's so easy. Similar to people criticize Dr. Oz for promoting these supplements and things that might not necessarily be proven by science. So I like to try, if I can, keep things separately, because there's nothing about Dr. Pepper. I think that they've combined recently with the Green Mountain K-Cups Keurig recently. So I guess coffee's good for you. It improves cognition. But otherwise, there was nothing great in terms of health and wellness about Dr. Pepper. So I was grateful for the fiduciary benefits of that. But beyond that, I was merely a spokesman briefly.
What's your favorite submission? What do you go to when you're just being lazy? And like, what's the one that you're always trying to set up?
Well, you know, a surprising amount of Brazilian jiu-jitsu knowledge or questions to ask for having not trained a significant amount, seemingly. I'm not sure, but you've never trained before in BJJ?
Not really. I'm just a fan. I've watched a lot of videos.
So at risk of letting my opponents know what I'm going for.
That's a good call.
I'll just put it on the line because I think it's Marcelo in New York City who likes to say that he doesn't care if opponents know what he's going for, what he's going to do. That's just going to make him
better.
And that's allow him to set up something else, another move after that, because they're going to be thinking I'm going for the guillotine or whatever. So I'll say that one of my favorite moves is the Ezekiel choke. Sounds violent.
Yeah, yeah.
Once again, jiu-jitsu is a peaceful art.
I know the Ezekiel choke, I think. Don't you use your gi on your arm?
You do. I have a gi right here. I'm sorry for leaving the screen briefly, but I got a gi. And the Ezekiel choke is based on, as you said, grabbing your own sleeve. So I like to, I'm letting all my secrets know, but once you advance in belt, it's bigger teaching than necessarily out competing in some way. So for all the viewers at home, this is an Ezekiel choke. What I like to do, and these are nuanced approaches here, I'm giving you all the nitty gritty details. When you're on top of someone, because you can do it from the bottom of someone's guard. You can even do it from inside someone else's guard. You can do it when you're in half mount. Guard meaning someone else's legs are wrapped around you when you're on your knees. For those listeners at home that aren't familiar with that, 90% plus of fights end up on the ground. So BJJ is based on the ground. And often the neutral position that people are in is called the guard. Someone else's legs wrap around you or your legs wrap around them when you are on your back. So whatever position you might be in, you're going to put one hand around the back of their neck, generally, with that hand free. And you're going to use this other sleeve here. We'll say it's my left hand that's free to kind of sneak it up there. I like to distract them. People think that you're just kind of resting the back of your the hand behind their head or trying to get control of them, but really you're setting something up. Because eventually you're going to free that left hand. They might be trying to grab it. You're going to free it to get it superior to their right hand so that you can grab their own sleeve and create a cinch. You're going to put this left hand in front of their neck and create, if you can see, this little square, or it turns into a bit of a triangle. And creating that, you're either pushing or you're extending your legs to close that space. So their neck is in this little hole here, as you can see, and you're closing that space. And that's a part of the choke.
Fun fact about the Ezekiel choke, if I'm not mistaken, there was a hiker who was attacked by, in the Pacific Northwest in the last year or two, was attacked by a mountain lion, and he killed the mountain lion with an Ezekiel choke.
Wow. Wow. Or we'll say temporarily stunned him, and then later he
put him to sleep. Let's put it that way.
For the Jains among us, the pacifists and the Jains.
It was the mountain lion or him that was going to go to sleep. It was one or the other. That's a cool thing about Brazilian Jiu-Jitsu. I mean, you're wearing clothes, right? And, I mean, that's your tool. It's your body and your clothes.
Yeah, and growing up wrestling, I'll say I was extremely put by the whole getup. Because you're wearing what's called a gi or a kimono. And, you're romping around in this. In wrestling, I'm used to either shorts and a t-shirt or a singlet. And I was just so taken aback by the fact that, one, you can grab other people, because that's illegal in wrestling. You're not supposed to be grabbing someone's headgear or their singlet or what have you. So you can grab that. And also there's an entire art. It looked like pajama pants to me initially.
Yeah.
But I'll say that there's almost a sacredness to grappling with the gi, because from a self-defense perspective, the other individual is going to be wearing clothes in most circumstances. Whether you're out in the street randomly in front of an ATM or at a bar somewhere at church, an individual that is going to approach you is probably going to be wearing a collar, maybe wearing sleeves, and definitely pants. And you can use the grips that you can attain to defend yourself and to neutralize that other individual. And that's part of the approach of a smaller or weaker person being able to defend themselves from a larger, stronger opponent. In this case, we have this, animal, this fierce animal that's undoubtedly stronger and more dangerous from a certain distance. But And if you're able to either close the space or keep the space far away, you know, you're at an advantage if you can use that material. So I agree with you. I've come a long way since my initial BJJ days where I thought the pajama pants were a little weird. And I've come to appreciate that these are tools to enhance self-defense. And there's a whole art. And I think that there's literally dozens of ways to neutralize or submit or choke, if you want to use that terminology, someone else with the gi.
For the guys who want to wear a singlet, you do have Eddie Bravo and 10th Planet and all that, and that whole school.
Yeah, and you keep going back to the 10th Planet, and I apologize, I haven't spoken about it earlier. I love those guys.
He's a wizard, man.
Yeah, and what's also interesting about them is they have their own names for moves, and you know, everything's named after, you know, some random object, that the electric chair, you know, the buzzer beater. You know, they have these weird names.
Yeah, there's a lot of like marijuana references, I feel like, in a lot of their, if I'm not mistaken.
Yeah, that's a cool group out there. There's another guy, I think it's Marvin de Cerberus Castile, I think is what he goes by. And he goes for a lot of leg locks and straight ankles and heel hooks and things like that. And they're masters at that, the 10th Planet. If I get any opportunity to train in BJJ, I'd probably like to at least hang out at a 10th Planet for a few months and learn from those guys.
It's a whole different thing.
Such a great sport. I went out to, tangentially again, I last competed internationally in Lisbon, Portugal for the European Championships a few years back. And other than the International Brazilian Jiu-Jitsu Championships that are here in the United States, I last went overseas to compete in Portugal, and I met this guy who was a purple belt at the time. I was just a white belt, and he was 74 years old from some Scandinavian country, I think Finland or something like that. And it just inspired me in many ways because he was in great shape, and he was talking about how he just enjoyed the art, and he was glad to be able to come out and compete. I said, you know, I'm going to be doing this until I'm in my 80s or 90s, hopefully. And it's something that, you know, unlike football or basketball, where you're a little more prone to, you know, have an ACL or MCL tear if you're full speed cutting past, you can go damn near 100% in Brazilian Jiu-Jitsu. And I think that there's a less likelihood that you're going to get injured because, you know, you're going to tap at the end of the day if you're experiencing any type of pain anywhere. There's humility in tapping. You know, if you're tapping dozens of times in one training session, hopefully that means you've learned something. And that's another brilliant facet of the sport and the art is, you know, there's the tap where you're essentially saying, hey, you know, you could have, you know, snapped my elbow there. You would have dislocated my shoulder there. Or, hey, you know, I would have been unconscious there.
Yeah, you can't really make an excuse for tapping, right? It's like you can't blame it on the ref making a bad call or something. It's like, yeah, no, I gave up because you were better than I was.
Yeah, and at that moment. And then the next time, maybe I'll best you, my friend. But at that time, you won. And it's the slap, bump, and roll again. And that's what I love about it.
This will be my last Brazilian Jiu-Jitsu question. Did you see the Korean Zombie submit the dude with the twister?
Yes, I did see that, actually.
My gosh, that was insane.
Yeah, that's a crazy move there, and I don't get it a lot. I think, yeah, there's been a few of those maybe in one championship in UFC, but yeah, that's a great move. I think in some levels of IBJJF, it might not even be legal.
I mean, you're like compressing the spinal cord or something.
Twisting it significantly, but you know, you can tap.
Switching sports, when you were playing rugby, who was the guy that you were like studying going, I want to be like this guy, I want to play like this guy?
Well, I'll say that, okay, so I was in Chula Vista, San Diego at the Olympic Training Center with Team USA competing to be a part of.
Was Todd Clever out there?
That's exactly, I was at training camp with this guy. And, you know, this was prior to, I think, him playing. I think he played in Japan and the other areas of Europe, if I'm not mistaken. But that was the dude that I was like, man, you're a little intimidated by this guy. And I'm just, I think it was 18, 19 years old. And you read my mind because I tackled him one time and I felt like I got tackled. I got him down. He probably at the time weighed a good 50, 60 pounds more than me. But like I said, my brother bullied me just enough when I was younger. My dad was firm enough with me when it came to sports that I was a tough cookie. I like to think I still am. You know, some days I have my days. But yeah, I just kind of laid. What do you do when you have this train coming at you?
That's where your faith comes into play, dude.
Exactly. So I just kind of threw my body and my shoulder in front of his knees, tried to wrap him up with the hope that I could come down. And he definitely ran me over, but I definitely wrapped him up enough to keep him down. And that's all I remember for the rest of that day. No, I'm just kidding. I didn't get concussed during that instance, but no, I definitely took a shot there. And it's so funny that you mentioned Todd Cleaver, because that's exactly who I think. I'm not sure if you looked this up, but that was the dude. That was one of the hardest hits that I've ever taken, and I was the one tackling somebody else.
He's an animal, man. I mean, there's that famous clip of, I think it's like the only try we scored against South Africa, and I think it was. Was it Brian Habana? Like he put on the deck with like a full on like facial disgracial.
Yeah, yeah.
Like
just stiff.
Ugly stiff arm. Oh, it was beautiful. Yeah. I was like, I jumped out of my seat and just screamed America at the top of my lungs.
Another guy was at that camp at the time was a gentleman by the name of Z Nguyen. And he was quick, man. And he was another guy that I admired at that camp. And I remember my goal during one training session was just to, you know, wrap him up if I could, just make sure that I stop him or at least slow him down for another teammate. But I remember he had this step. What a lot of rugby guys have the step. They got the before they. It's like a little hot. We don't do that in American football. That's not a move, really. American football is more cut and go. But the rugby thing, I think, it's something about having more space.
It's all about timing and kind of getting, you got more space. You're trying to get people to take a step.
Right. But he hit me with one of those, man. And I ended up reaching a little bit. So Z Nguyen, shout out to Z Nguyen, man. He probably doesn't even remember me, but he did burn me. I tackled him at one point. But during that particular play, he definitely burned me.
Well, now you got Carlin Isles and who's the other guy who's amazing? Baker.
Speedster. Yeah.
Yeah, those guys are insane.
And United States has done such a great job at developing the sport here over the years. I like to think that I was one of the best, and that's why I was selected to be a part of the U19s and go on this Team USA pool. But the reality is that back in 2006, 2007, you know, I'm just not sure that we had the numbers at that time. You know, I was quick. Nothing special, though.
Yeah, you still got to be an athlete for sure. You know the history. One of the interesting. I don't know if you learned about this in California, but you, I don't know if you know that in I want to say it was like 1905 or 1906. There were like 20 deaths in American college football that year, and California, being the progressive state that it is. Even back then, banned football from college. And so American rules, you know, association football, gridiron football. And so Cal Berkeley, Stanford, and I'm trying to remember who else, but they kept playing union rugby. And so those, because it was safer and it was legal, it was legal in their state. Teddy Roosevelt actually got involved in revising some of the rules in American football to make it safe again. But yeah, so the legacy of rugby in California, I mean, those guys, you know, rugby came before football to America, and you know, Yale and a lot of those schools, Ivy League schools, Harvard were big into rugby, and then, you know, and then football came. But because of that, California, Cal Berkeley, Stanford in particular, have had this amazing long tradition of rugby that's still amazing. And you probably know this. Sorry to interrupt again, but this is just a cool story. I love rugby, man. I love rugby so much. But did you know that one of the guys, one of the only plane that was hijacked in 9/11 that didn't hit its target, didn't hit their target because there was a Cal Berkeley rugby player on the plane who organized the other passengers basically to scrum down on a drink cart and bust through the door and took the terrorist down and they ended up crashing in a field. But that was one of the rugby players from Cal Berkeley.
Powerful. Yeah, that's a powerful story and unfortunate, but we're certainly grateful for that sacrifice and skills all around that you learn from sports in many ways. I'll say, physiologically speaking, you mentioned the band. I can see why rugby would be safer. They had the leather helmets back in 1905, I'm thinking, but these days with the metal helmets, in many ways, they're almost weapons. They're used as weapons in many ways. You know, they've created the targeting rules and things like this. But you know, back in 1905, you know, that wasn't a thing. It was just, you know, kill or be killed. And up until the early 2000s, I think people were still used as a weapon in many ways. So the technique of tackling someone in rugby, you know, getting your head, you know, behind seemingly instead of in front, in many ways can be safer. It doesn't always wind up safe, but
it's illegal in rugby to leave your feet in a tackle. It's illegal to hit without wrapping up. And so those two things change it a lot. But yeah, I mean, I think the bottom line is the way I think about it is you give players pads so that they can do things with their body that their body's not supposed to do. Right. I mean, you take the pads off and all of a sudden your own, you know, sense of self-preservation kicks and you don't lead with your face to smash somebody, you know, in a tackle, when you're a running back or whatever. I mean, there's just things you do that you would never do if you didn't have that artificial. But the thing is, it'll protect your nose from getting broken, right? And from getting stitches on your eyebrow, your lips, but your brain is still smashing into the inside of your skull.
The whiplash and the trauma that your brain is going to take is a little bit more severe. But I agree with you that not having the pads is going to essentially make you think a little bit more about, okay, how am I really going to put my cranium in danger in this realm? I agree with you completely.
What's the best advice you've been given as a physician?
The best advice I've been given as a physician is probably that it's a marathon, not a sprint. And it's a bit cliche, but since junior high and high school, I've always been kind of a sprinter in more ways than one. But particularly when it came to academics, you know, I would stay up until 4 o'clock, 5 o'clock in the morning to have to wake up at 6 or 7 and, take the test the next day and then go play a football game and then maybe prepare for a jazz singer show choir event the next morning. And I've always just been kind of go, 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 go. But I think medical school and residency allowed me to appreciate that, you have to pace yourself and it's really important to think about your longevity in this and knowing that medical knowledge is infinite. So it's going to take an infinite curiosity to maintain it. And that goes for any field. And I think to take it back to how these pillars are all related, we talk about art and sports and academia, medicine, and even humanitarianism. I think what's also linked in all of them is this infinite curiosity that you have to continuously excel. So thinking about it as a marathon and not a sprint will allow you to sprint when you need to, when you have the energy to, but lay back a little bit and consider that longevity and understand that you're in it for decades to come, hopefully, and pacing yourself is of utmost importance.
All right, last question. What's the craziest experience you've had so far? Let's limit it to your medical experiences, because it sounds like you've done a lot of crazy stuff.
Obviously, COVID-19 and everything that's happened with that has been quite extraordinary in terms of the experiences that we've had. And I think a lot of people have a similar experience to that in ICUs around the country. So I'll just leave that alone. Everybody knows how intense that's been with intubating individuals and, you know, having to adjust vent settings with the new literature that's out there about how we can, you know, optimize people getting off the vent as soon as possible or improve ventilation, oxygenation, or perfusion in many ways. So I'll leave that alone and take it back to something that's also a bit more crazy. I guess in medical school, knowing I had this interest in acute care, Mount Sinai has this affiliation with Elmhurst Hospital. And it is literally what some would argue to be the in the most diverse area of the world. Because Jackson Heights, Queens, Elmhurst Hospital, you know, has a significant population from South Asia, from Latin America, from, you know, African nations, both Eastern and Western Europe, and obviously Americans. And you just have this crazy melting pot in Jackson Heights. But I'm hanging out there, as I often did throughout my medical school education. I often was the guy who just liked to spend time in the hospital. A lot of people might you know, stay away or just go home to, you know, read when they can. And you know, I would like to read in the hospital. And then if something interesting happened, I would go out there and you know, be able to take part in it. But it was New Year's Eve into New Year's Day when I was, I think, either a second or a third year medical student at Mount Sinai, hanging out at Elmhurst Hospital, working with Ruben Schreyer, who is actually a guru in emergency medicine. No longer with Mount Sinai. I think he transitioned to Maimonides or another significantly academically successful hospital out in New York City. But in comes a machete attack. And this individual had had to have a good three or four dozen sutures. You could just see this laceration was about from here, the right anterior frontal region, all the way down to the right side of his head, past the temple, down to his neck. And, you know, I had sutured a fair amount there prior to that, obviously doing my surgery rotations and things, but this is my first extended lac repair there. As a med student in this diverse neighborhood from a machete attack, right as the clock struck. And that was probably one of the craziest things. That's when I really fell in love, I think, with the acute care and emergency medicine in general, is kind of feeling like I had a bit of divine power. Not to sound pompous, but I think it was really, you know, God or the universe or whatever you believe in working through my hands, because I was kind of right in the zone, as they say, just as you get in the zone when you're in the middle of a football game, just as you're in the zone when you're performing on stage. We've controlled the majority of the bleeding, but, you know, Dr. Strayer, with his excellent supervision, just allowed me to do my work and do what I'd been taught. And I'm grateful to him for that learning experience and to do it in such a location, for that really to be the beginning of my career in that light. I really appreciated that.
What a crazy, crazy experience. Well, hey, this has been a lot of fun, and I look forward to getting to know you better. And I'm sure we're gonna have more conversations in the future. But thanks for doing this with us and sharing your story. It's been delightful.
But so you're just in Huntsville then?
Yeah, come on up, man.
I guess that's 3 hours. If I'm in Haleyville,
that's like an hour and a half away.
Yeah, I'll have to hit you with the beer and hymns and beyond.
We'll make it happen. We'll make it happen. I know what dates you're going to be there, so I'll I'll look it up and we'll coordinate it.
I do appreciate it. Thank you so much for the time, and thanks for listening to my extended stories, making short stories long. But I'd be happy to do it again soon.
Awesome, man. Well, have a great rest of your evening, and we'll be in touch. Thanks again.
Peace and love. Yeah, rugby or jujitsu or whatever, we can make it happen.
Singing. Look forward to next time. Yeah. All right, we'll sounds good. All right. We'll see you.
Take care. Peace and love.
Thank you for listening to Branch Out by Sycamore. Check us out at sycamoredocs.com. That's sycamoredocs.com.